Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're turning our attention now to a new book. It's titled Anthropause, The Beauty of Degrowth. And our guest is the author, Stan Cox. Stan writes about the economic and political roots of the global ecological crisis. He's the author of 7 books, including The Green New Deal and Beyond, Ending the Climate Emergency While We Still Can. And as we talk with Stan about his book, his new book and latest book, Anthropause, want to hear from you. What are your ideas for how we could live more sustainably? What could you live without? How do you imagine a sustainable food or transportation system working? Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Stan Cox, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
It was great to be with you, Larry.
I appreciate it, and I found your book very interesting. And it started, as I understand, or your idea for it started back in 2020.
It sort of did. Editor, just a couple of years ago, he gave me a call and said, "I've got a title for you. You can write a book under this title, and it's a one-word title, and it will draw a lot of readers." And I said, "Well, what's the word?" He said, "Anthropause." And so I said, "Okay, I'll look that up and see what it is and get back to you." But he was right. I don't know about how it'll draw readers, but he was right. It's a very interesting phenomenon. The term ecologist in the spring and early summer of 2020 used this term as to describe that period during which we had COVID lockdowns over much of the country and world, and there was a remarkable resurgence of nature just in that short time. And we saw pictures of wild animals wandering around in Times Square, and the birds were singing more, and their greenhouse gas emissions dropped by 20% worldwide temporarily. There were pictures of people in India looking off on the horizon and seeing the Himalayas for the first time. And so I thought, okay, that the story of the anthropologist would make a good opening parable, sort of, for a book about degrowth. And, of course, it's not that we should advocate another lockdown, a permanent lockdown of people in their homes, but we can look through the anthropos and see what is all the stuff that we normally do that was suspended and allowed the earth to recover at least temporarily. So it's not that our bodies weren't present out in the world. It's that all the stuff that we do out in the world, especially in the course of supplying our economies with more and more extracted resources, fossil fuels, minerals, land territory, et cetera, that we were not intruding on the earth as much. And so then I went on with, so I, you know, that's the, just the beginning of the first chapter, and then the rest of the book is about degrowth.
Yeah, and this whole concept of degrowth, there are several definitions of degrowth. Tell us which we need to know for this discussion.
I guess first it's good to say what degrowth is not, yeah. and that it's it's understandably misunderstood, I guess, because people just will assume that it means we have to reduce the gross national product we need to shrink our economies, but everybody needs to be poorer, but that's obviously not it. The core concept of the degrowth movement is the one essential thing is to reduce the quantities of fossil fuels and other extracted resources, especially minerals, that we are putting through the economy, that are they're being taken from the earth, used to produce a lot of stuff, much of it either unnecessary or outright harmful, and then all of that ending up waste at the other end. That sequence has to be interrupted. Once you do that, though, the degrowth movement emphasizes, you have to be much more careful about how we use the resources that we're still using. That is, to fulfill people's basic needs, improve well-being for everybody, with equality, and so forth.
Yeah. Some people, at first glance, some people might be scared of degrowth because you're talking about, in some ways, sacrificing what people might view as life's luxuries or things that they become accustomed to, I guess. But you call these happy subtractions. Subtractions.
Yes. When people there's a an interesting study published recently in which they surveyed people in the U.S. and U.K. and half of the people, they just asked them, what are your feelings about degrowth? Should we have a degrowth economy? And then they don't explain what that is or anything. And three-fourths of the respondents say, no, I don't want that, because they've been told all their life that without growth, civilization is going to end. But the other half of the population that was surveyed were given a description of what is envisioned with degrowth from the researchers who are advocating it, and all the stuff I just described, to say we're not going to waste resources to produce simply to produce profits for the upper half of the or upper 10% of the income wealth earners, And we're going to, it's all going to be used to improve everyone's well-being. And then three-fourths of the respondents said, yes, yeah, let's have that. So, in the book, what I, the central argument I tried to make is that people, as you say, people are still going to, even if they understand what degrowth is, there's going to be worry about what am I going to have to give up? What sacrifices am I going to have to deal with? And I decided just for now, let's do a thought experiment and say that we do achieve a degrowth economy. Instead of thinking about the sacrifice and so forth, let's look at all the terrible things in our economy and society today that are made possible by overuse of fossil fuels and other resources, and say, okay, if we do drastically reduce our use of those things, how many of those ills and harms and annoyances and nuisances that we deal with today, how many of those will be subtracted from the economy? We won't have to deal with them anymore. They'll be in the past. And how will people's lives be better?
Yeah. You might talk about, or you do talk about, I shouldn't say you might, you do talk about degrowth as a way to solve societal issues, like racism even.
Right. And those solutions would be byproducts of having reduced our impact on the earth. I got into a few seemingly small things that that you would think, well, for example, leaf blowers, you would think, well, we're not going to save the earth by getting rid of leaf blowers. But no, it's the other way around. Doing what is needed to keep a livable earth will mean that we can't have the horrific noise pollution from leaf blowers. There would also be a justice element to it, because of like 80 or 90% of gas-powered leaf blower use is by commercial landscaping companies, and the employees of those companies are very often they're poorly paid. Many times recent immigrants, they're often people of color, and they're getting that noise from the leaf blower, which is approximately it's like standing right next to a jet engine when it's just the leaf blower is engine is just a couple of feet from the ears, and even ear protection isn't all that good. So that's a very micro example. A much bigger one, I should say, that is very relevant today, because it's what is in all the national news is that, you know, with a degrowth society, we would not in any way have the resources that are needed to run our $1 trillion a year military industrial complex. And a degrowing society and world could not afford war fighting in preparation for war fighting. Mm. And so I argue in the book that the 3.5 million people who are employed in and around the military would, in the U.S., would have a great improvement in their quality of life. And the rest of the world would obviously be much better off.
Our guest today, Stan Cox. His book is entitled, the main title is Anthropause, subtitled The Beauty of Degrowth. Questions or comments, I hope you'll join in. The number 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're visiting with author Stan Cox about his latest book titled Anthropause, The Beauty of Degrowth. And again, you can join in, number 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. And let's take a call. Kate in Washburn, what's on your mind?
Hi. So a number of years ago, the author Barbara Kingsolver wrote a great book called Animal Vegetable Miracle. And in there, she talks about that if every family just ate locally sourced foods for one meal a week, it would significantly reduce the fossil fuel use because of reductions in transportation for foods that we have the luxury of eating all day long or all year long. Like, you know, do we really need to have our strawberries in January? But it seems like a sacrifice of local food for one meal a week, and if everybody did that, it's not that big of a sacrifice, and it would make a big difference in fossil fuel use. So there's just one idea.
Yeah, Kate, thanks a lot for calling. Comment on that, Stan.
Yes, you're exactly right, and Chapter 4 of Anthropause is where I deal with the food system, and it really needs to be completely overhauled, because right now the farmer's field is just is kind of at the center of a whole bunch of industries that are parasitic on it. The equipment and chemical and fertilizer industries, and especially all the industries that support the feedlot and confined animal feeding facilities, those industries are generating lots more wealth, you can call it, than the farmers producing, and they're also having much greater negative impact on society. And then downstream from the farmers, you've got the grain trading companies, transportation of the food, and then huge food processing industries that take quite good, nutritious food and turn it into something that's not really food. And then it continues through the retailing, restaurant industries, et cetera. And so all of that stuff is much of it is unnecessary. And as you say, the as much localization of food production as possible is needed. And this is another area where there will be great leaps in socioeconomic justice, because in order to have strawberries in winter and all that kind of stuff, there has to be a huge, highly exploited workforce in California, Florida, et cetera, and in Mexico. And so that, with that in many other ways, overhauling the food system would rid us of many of the ills that we're experiencing.
Yeah, I think you reported in your book that 90% of our cropland goes into like four crops: corn, soybeans, cotton, and wheat.
Right, and only one of those four crops is something that humans eat directly, except for tiny bits of sweet corn, which is a very tiny part of the corn crop, and a little bit of food-grade soybean. And the rest of corn and soybeans go to feeding animals. And so it's only the wheat that we're eating directly. And the feeding of corn and soybeans to cattle is doubly wasteful, because they are not built, their bodies and digestive systems are meant for eating vegetation, leaves, et cetera, that are grasses that are very high in cellulose and so forth, and so you put 10 pounds of corn into cattle, and you get 1 pound of actual nutrition out of them.
Hmm. Mark in Wisconsin Dells has some maybe a little pushback here. Mark, hello.
Yeah, hi, Larry. How are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I've thought about this subject quite a bit, actually, because I have neighbors that drive up to Wisconsin from Illinois and other states every weekend to go to their lake houses. And I'm thinking, when that has to end, there'll be dramatic effects on the economy of Wisconsin because of the tourism industry and everything associated with it. The answer to the problem, potentially, might be electric cars and a lot more charging stations. And before I get any comment to my comment, since I got you on the phone, I want to say we're going to miss you when you retire. And a suggestion for a show would be to discuss the psychological dysphoria that you're going to suffer, like we all do when we retire. Things change.
Things change, yeah. Well, and Mark, thanks for those comments. I'll be Stan probably doesn't know this, but I'll be retiring in June after 50. It'll be 59 years on the air. So,
wow! Congratulations.
that's a long time. But to his point, what would happen if we couldn't drive people from Illinois, for example, couldn't drive to Wisconsin? And he suggests we need more electric vehicles. And you do address vehicles quite a bit, and even electric vehicles come in for some problem areas.
That's right. The problem is not just that we have way too many private vehicles on the road. And it's it's not that we have too many fuel-burning cars on the road. It's we have too many cars, period, because many of the problems caused by what one scholar, I use his term in the book, he calls automobile supremacy, that we're putting automobiles' well-being above the well-being of humans in designing our society around them. Electric vehicles cause a lot of the same problems, and they're one benefit that they have fewer greenhouse gas emissions. They're not zero greenhouse gas emissions. It's just fewer because their manufacture requires a lot more resources, especially the metals that go into the battery, and they also are drawing on an electricity grid that is still largely powered by fossil fuels. And one more interesting thing about that they're finding out about EVs is that the tires wear out much more quickly, because I'm not sure exactly how it works, but they have a system where they automatically apply the brakes when the car is moving forward, which helps generate a little extra current to go into the battery and charge it. But that also causes the tires to wear much faster, which then produces a lot of microplastic, tiny, tiny particles of rubber going off into nature, which is already a big problem with the current fleet of cars and tires. And one dealer says people are coming to him and saying, "Hey, these were 40,000-mile tires, and I only got 15,000 miles on them." So, the bottom line is that instead of having vehicles, whether gas or electric or powered, going from Illinois up to vacation in Wisconsin, we need a much bigger and more efficient passenger rail system that would reach not just Chicago and L.A., but would go into all kinds of places like central Wisconsin, and then you would need other public transportation from those nodes.
Yeah, I was really fascinated when I read that part about the tires, because I did not know that. And a listener called, couldn't stay with us. He says the wear on tires is also from the extra weight of the EV tires, maybe not as much the brakes, but that's a possibility too. Mark, thanks again. Maurice in Madison, we'll turn to you now. Thank you for calling.
Hello. You're probably aware of the work of Herman Daly, great economist. He was the chief economist at the World Bank. So he wrote about steady state economics in the early 1980s. Nobody listened. You could you could go to the UW and see if you can find one economist who even knows about Herman Davy. It's just verboten. I think, you know, it seems, I tuned in a little late, but it seems like you're talking about things we should do. This system will not change willingly. As one great economist in the 1800s pointed out, capitalism contains the seeds of its own ruin. It's going to fail soon.
Yeah.
You know.
Stan, that's kind of, and you talk about that in the book. I mean, all right, there's going to be a lot of pushback on this whole business, but there is going to come a time when we're going to have to do something like it.
Right. Yeah. It's, that's degrowth. Well, not degrowth, but growth is going to end. It's that's inevitable. As the there was a guy named Stein, who an economist who said, if some his rule of thumb was, if something can't go on forever, it won't. And that's what growth, you know, there's just only so much, there are only so many resources, there's only so much pollution the world can take, et cetera. And so growth is going to end either, if we go on with business as usual, it's going to end in a kind of a Mad Max free-for-all downward spiral, or if pursuing the path of degrowth, we could achieve what's sometimes called a soft landing and have a very different world. Either way, the world is going to have to be very different from the way it is today. And the economists who have ignored what Herman Daly wrote and spoke about for many years are they were able to do that because we were still cruising along on burning more and more fossil fuels every year, et cetera, and nothing, it didn't seem like anything was going wrong with that. And now we know that it's taken us toward Mad Max world.
Yeah. Michael had emailed kind of in support of that, saying we live on a planet with finite resources, yet we pursue endlessly the growth of the economy. And the world population is still growing. It seems more and more people wanting more and more stuff in kind of inflationary. Yet Michael has never heard the proponents of growth make the connection between a fixed supply of resources and the growing demand of those resources, which is kind of what you're addressing.
Right. And the so-called green growth advocates keep urging that with technology and increasing efficiency more and more, so that you get more production out of the same quantity of fuel or the same quantity of aluminum or whatever the inputs are, that efficiency can just keep going forever. But that, that's not true. You can't get the quantity of resources going into a process down to zero. In fact, you can't get it anywhere close to zero. So you can make remarkable progress in, say, the number of miles per gallon that you get with vehicles, or at least prototype vehicles, but you're not going to get ones that run on no energy input at all. And if there's a diminished returns, if you are thinking that you can keep growth going forever by through efficiency.
Our guest today, Stan Cox, his book is titled Anthropause, The Beauty of Degrowth. Hope you'll join in with your thoughts as well. There have been some good comments here along the way. You could call us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Stan Cox, author of Anthropause, The Beauty of Degrowth. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Email from Bob, how can reduction in air travel help our environment? And I noted some interesting numbers in you certainly address this. Fewer than 20% of the people in the world have ever flown. And here in the U.S., 12% of the Americans in the U.S. take 2/3 of all flights.
Right. And so, deeply reducing air travel would not impact the majority of people in the world, and it would, as I understand it, the emissions from aircraft, the greenhouse gas emissions, are magnified for a given quantity of emissions that go out of the jet engine of the aircraft, you get a greater amount of global warming because they're being emitted at 30 or 40,000 feet up in the air. So what I kind of use air travel in the book as one of the that its elimination or deep reduction would not only help deal with climate change, but it would create some of the great happy subtractions, because the minority of people who fly frequently, to them, and it's many polls have shown this, that it's becoming one of the more and more miserable experiences from start to finish. Nobody except for people who can afford to fly first class or elite class and those things, nobody really enjoys flying. It's not something that back in the 50s and 60s, when just a few people were doing it, it was quite an adventure. But it's, the airlines are very good at making you miserable enough that you'll pay extra fees to get another couple of inches or leg room, or actually be able to sit together with your family in adjacent seats.
I was thinking about flying way back a long time ago when one of the airlines, Midwest maybe, I got served lobster for a meal.
Yeah.
And the seats were wide. And yeah. You had leg room.
Yeah.
Martha in Menominee, we'll turn to you. Hi, Martha.
What's that? Hey, Larry. Really enjoying this discussion, and I got to say, I got to give a shout out to your guest for considering the health impacts that our society has on minority people who are maybe first generation in this country and take jobs that other people don't want to do. So good on you there, Mr. Author, for putting that out there to the people that listen to Larry's show. But my question is about microplastics and plastics in general. I've been trying to reduce my use of plastic over the years. I just buy, you know, half and half in the waxy cardboard cartons. I try not to use Ziploc plastic bags. I use tin foil or paper instead. When I bake, I try to use, you know, wax paper, things like that, instead of plastic. But I'm wondering if your guest could speak to this. Even when we had the farm, back when my husband and I had the farm, we would use paper feed bags for garbage bags instead of plastic bags. But tell me, I'd like your guest to speak to this and what the army of Larry's listeners could do if we all join forces and quit using so much plastic.
Well, I'm with you on the trash bags. I don't have a farm, or I didn't. I just recently moved from Kansas to Michigan, but in Kansas, one of my coworkers had a lot of animals on his place, and so he would every couple of months would bring me all the empty feed sacks that he had used, and so I was able to avoid buying those big black plastic bags. But now I'm stuck. I don't have a source of those things. But the amount of unnecessary plastic being produced is ridiculous. And many cities, at least in the world, in Mumbai, India, where my in-laws live, they've outlawed plastic bags, and it's not the end of the world. Everybody carries bags around. I guess there's some U.S. cities too that do that. But on the other hand, whenever I've been visiting somebody in the hospital, or I go to the doctor, I think the practice of medicine without plastic would be it would be pretty much impossible to do much of what's being done. So in a degrowth society, most plastic production could probably be eliminated, but there would be certain uses like that where plastic would still, and fossil fuels would still have to be a few of them set aside to make plastics for things like hospital use, or you can think of other essential uses.
Yeah. Martha, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, one of the interesting points you talk about, you write about the photos of Peter Menzel's Material World, a Global Family Portrait. And that was really interesting to me, his work and why these photos fascinate you.
Yeah, I think the world's greatest coffee table book, although it's not that big. But what this photographer did was to round up another 16 or 20 photographers, and they fanned out across the all the Earth's continents and went to each one, went to a different country and found a more or less statistically average family, or I guess you could say the median family for pretty much all characteristics, not just income. Spent a couple of weeks with them, taking pictures and asking them questions and having them tell them about their lives. But at the end of the 2 weeks, then they it was arranged that the family would bring all of their movable possessions out of their house, out of the backyard, et cetera, and arrange them in front of their home and then pose with all of their possessions. And you can imagine that going from Bhutan to Ethiopia to Germany, United States, the Congo, you know, it's such a stark contrast. And what was even more interesting, probably, is that they asked each family two questions. What is your most prized possession? And if you could have more possessions, what would you want to be able to have? You can still find it online called Material World, and Peter Menzel, I think it's M-E-N-Z-E-L. He did another one, and that book was from 1994. He did another one in the mid-2000s called, I think it was called What We Eat or something, but they did the same thing, but the people displayed a week's, all the food that they would, the kinds of food they would, and quantity that they would consume within a week.
And it was, and the difference in terms of the size, the amount, is just kind of a staggering difference. And, you know, here we are coming up to the end of our show, and we haven't gotten into a third of what you write about in your book, which is fascinating. But I liked your last line in your book, where you say Western society must act as if the world can have a livable future. What we should not do, however, is to expect that a better future will look anything like our present. And I that's kind of the point. And you talk about all of the differences and all of the things that probably are going to happen whether we want to or not. And let's try and do it in a way that gives us a softer landing than what could be the case. And really fascinating, Stan, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today and talking about your book, Anthropause, The Beauty of Degrowth. And Stan Cox is the author. It's great to have him with us, and great to have you listening in today on the show. I want to thank you so much for that. And of course, a big thanks to our normal our normal folks here who produce the show. Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and thank you for listening. And please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.